from your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, November 30th, 2025. For those listening in Chicago, I hope your driveways and roads are clear after the recent blizzard, largest snowfall in recorded history for the city of Chicago in the month of November, so that's fun. Good news for us at Sox Machine, we'll be in Orlando, Florida next week at this time, reporting from the winter meetings. We are hopeful activity will pick up for the White Sox, but signings have been trickling in around Major League Baseball, including an old friend, Dylan Cease, who signed a 7-year deal with the Toronto Blue Jays. We'll talk about that signing as it fits the correlation of former White Sox aces cashing in big after being traded away from Chicago. Bo Jackson recently turned 63 years old and got me thinking, if you could travel back in time to watch one White Sox player in their prime, who would it be? Also, is the Pope getting tired of all these White Sox gifts? So let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter, James Fegan, and managing editor, Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. Let's start with the big news around Major League Baseball as far as the latest big signing. Dylan Cease, old friend, signs a 7-year, $210 million contract to now pitch for the Toronto Blue Jays. And James, I'll start with you. What's your initial reaction to this signing? Because for me, I'm a bit surprised he signed for this long of a deal and for this much money.
Having covered him, my initial reactions were like, will he upgrade his like B setup? Will his like, disc golf, the courses that he's building in Georgia, like have some extra level of like tricked out or robo butlers come to mind. But as far as like looking at his profile a little bit, maybe in the last 3 minutes on his Fangraphs page, like he obviously like his ERA was like a lot worse than his peripherals last year. And like that hasn't been super consistent over the course of his career. A lot of things like in terms of how much chase he's generating, like overall contact rate in zone, like a lot of things were like back to like 2022 levels last season. Where I think you could kind of convince yourself to being looking at him a little bit like maybe with like Zach Wheeler when he hit free agency comes to mind. I think that'd be, outlandish cop in terms of like what the back half of Wheeler's career has looked at. But in terms of like why he was appealing to the Sox then, it was like, here's this guy with like huge stuff, pretty young, even though he's hitting free agency, like, or at least relatively, where you still think you're getting prime years. And maybe I like you can see like top of the rotation stuff, but not the production where you're maybe paying as much as that would cost. Like, this is obviously isn't like $300 million or Yamamoto territory, where I think you can talk yourself into the idea of like, we're paying big time dollars, we're paying a hefty price, but if we think there might be a little bit of a late number one upside, or certainly like he's had a number one like level season in the past, maybe there's a little chance for us to. Maybe it's a bit rosier picture than just like, hey, the market for starting pitching is clearly insane that we have to pay a mid four ERA guy, $210 million. I will say like it's been reeled off a lot. He doesn't accumulate innings quite in the fashion where you associated him as a workhorse because he has so many like inefficient five and dive starts, but everyone brings it up about him. Does not miss starts, has been incredibly healthy, especially for a guy who was drafted basically when he was blown out, and so much of like his prospect coverage was like, well, he's coming off TJ and he's not really like starting like a starter yet, but like, whoa, ho, ho, look at this stuff. Now it's to him be in this place in his career where his stuff has been really loud and he's been able to maintain it pretty close to his velocity, even though it's waned a little bit the last couple of years, and healthy for 30 starts a year. I think we would have taken that in 2017 with what the state of Cease was at the time when he was acquired. So I think with how healthy he's been, how relatively consistent in some of the underlying stuff he's been, I think he'd be like, well, this guy's really only just started shaving his walk rates under 10%, just starting to figure out the pitch in some respects, even his 2022 season, which is like slider, slider, slider all the time. It's getting a little bit more complex in sequencing and mixing and shapes over the last couple of years, where you could still imagine his best years ahead of him. That said, the White Sox certainly felt like, and the returns for his trade isn't looking super great, but they kind of felt like teams didn't see him as a number one or number two starter, that they saw the walks and they saw like kind of just not that many ways of getting people out that he had. He's just trying to like execute the perfect pitch with really good stuff over and over again, that they didn't see like top end stuff or top end starter ingredients for him. So I think there's probably two different views of him across the league, where maybe his price kind of fell in the middle of those two camps a little bit, but certainly looking at like what the White Sox return has been or what it's currently been able to produce, or what it's just looking like at this point, a lot riding on Drew Thorpe for value. It's not feeling like that's the other side of a $210 million contract right here, but that was their front office for just getting started, ideally, in terms of trade quality since then.
No, that's a good point, James. How about you, Jim? What do you make of Dylan Cease signing for 7 years and $210 million?
On one hand, you look at what Blake Snell got, which is kind of similar AAV, 5 years instead of seven, but Snell's 3 years older, and you think like, well, they're both kind of inefficient pitchers, or they both can make dominant stuff or dominant peripherals kind of look miserable or look like a slog in getting there. Cease is super durable, makes every start. Snell is not super durable, but when he does throw 180 innings, he wins a Cy Young. And if he's healthy enough for postseason, you want him pitching game one or game two. Whereas like Cease, not necessarily an ironclad postseason. Like he'd be starting a postseason game, but nobody's saying we need to get this guy two starts in one postseason, or at least that has not been the experience yet. So, they have strengths and weaknesses, but, I was kind of surprised Snell got what he got. And so I'm kind of surprised that Cease got what he got. But, I guess my surprise is less just because it does seem like for a type of pitcher who a team might see, like this guy's got, still has some of the best swing and miss stuff in the game. If only we can get him to do this. If only I can fix him. I can take what's broken and fix him and make him ideal. Like, I think there might be some of that stuff going into it versus like, I'm going to take somebody with ordinary ingredients and make him good. Like, I think they see the last mile towards Cy Young votes a lot easier in a case like Cease. So if you have money and you need a pitcher, and I think the Jays were going to get a pitcher of some kind. I think Framber Valdez was the other one they were tied to. It's like, well, I guess you got to pay for it. And even if you think like there's inefficiency, and so you add a year for like a great free agent, like 6 years still felt like a lot. I thought maybe he'd be like well paid for five like Snell was. But and the other thing I thought was that it might take a while for Scott Boras to get the deal he wanted, just because of this push and pull between like how durable he is, how little you have to worry about him over the course of a season versus what does he look like at the end of a season? I thought there might be a little bit more haggling over, well, how much should I need to pay this guy if I don't want him starting game one of a World Series? Like, I could see that being maybe a point of contention, but that was not the case. So I think maybe the speed that they reach a deal was more surprising than ultimately the AAV or the, maybe like the term of the contract's 1 year longer than I thought, but that's about it.
I think, does Toronto still have to overpay in order to get premium free agents to convince players to play their home games in Canada? Is that still a thing, James, around baseball? Because I know they tried in the past. Obviously, they went hard after Shohei Ohtani, and that was the impression, is that because they're the only team in Canada, they may have to pay more than other teams to lure free agents to them.
I feel like it's maybe played a factor in them finishing second place some in the past. I think it's obviously less so after winning the pennant. Certainly would have been a more complicated situation a couple of years back when Dylan wasn't pitching Toronto for vaccine restrictions. But I think coming off of like where they've been and, they've been throwing money around for a while. They clearly have resources. They've been tending to win and coming off a championship. I feel like this is a winter where it would be less of a factor than any. I think Dylan Cease is pretty straightforward. Hey, do you want to pitch in playoff games? you want to compete in the AL East, I think they're offering a pretty big stage at this point. So what would Cease's market have shaken out to if we, you know, took this another couple of months? I don't know. Maybe more, maybe less, but given the kind of paucity of starting pitching options, you know, I think the other one person ranked above him, Framber Valdez, kind of both has a difference in age, more like postings of miles on him, and his own kind of warts to consider as well. I think he was going to do well in this market. You know, Toronto won. That kind of just speaks to them being viable going forward.
Yeah, I mean, they have spent a lot of money to keep Vladimir Guerrero Jr. They got George Springer, which that was a surprise when they did sign George Springer a few years Gausman. Ago. Kevin Gausman. Yeah, now the Blue Jays front three of their starting rotation looks good. Like Kevin Gausman.
Kirk extension, another big spend that they did.
Yeah. So Treya Savage, Dylan Cease. So that's their front three that they're going to be rolling with in 2026. I don't hate the signing for Toronto. I think it just, I was a bit surprised with the way that Dylan Cease pitched in 2025. He ended up getting a 7-year deal for $210 million. But maybe I shouldn't have been surprised when you look at the past White Sox aces that this organization has traded and the contracts that they have signed with their new teams. Chris Sale signed a 5-year, $145 million contract with the Boston Red Sox after being traded by the White Sox. After being traded from the White Sox to the Red Sox, Garrett Crochet signed a 6-year, $170 million contract. And now Dylan Cease signs a 7-year, $210 million contract. Jim Margulis, ex-White Sox aces, are doing great. If I'm Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, I'm going to pitch my butt off so in 4 years I can get traded and I can, never mind, I don't want to be that dour. But it does raise the question, especially directed to Mr. Justin Ishbia. You have two potential aces in your farm system that I think we're all hopeful for, that everything clicks in 2026, and we are just as excited about Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith in the second half of this upcoming season as we were pleasantly surprised, maybe a bit shocked, and how well Colson Montgomery hit the ground running for the White Sox in his rookie debut. Schultz and Smith, if they do that, just continues this somewhat of a lengthy line of the White Sox finding aces and developing them and getting success on the starting pitching front. But if they want to stick around a long time, which is now the fear in White Sox heads, is like fans' heads, like, yeah, if Hagen Smith pitches really well, how long before they trade him? Which history says not that long. So, but if you want them to stick around, this is the asking price. And if you're Noah Schultz and Hagensworth or any good starting pitcher, Paul Skeens or anyone like that, the bar's set. $30 million, 5+ years. And that could be a future problem the White Sox will have to address.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long-standing Reinsdorf thing when it comes to budging beyond 3 years for pitchers. He occasionally breaks it. I think, was it Scott Linebrink was the first one he broke it on, which was very funny in terms of, like, the style of pitcher, you know, non-dominant reliever to get that deal. And then how it worked out, like John Danks getting 5 years and then not working out. Like, I think, you know, when the White Sox have broached it or breached, I should say, it's, you know, hasn't really paid the kind of dividends that, you know, you go to Reinsdorf and say, like, see, this is the way we got to do this more often. So I do think it requires ownership that's less, or more accepting of inefficiency or lost deals, or so like, oh, that one didn't work out. We can cover it up with another big contract. Like it takes that kind of attitude, I think, to pay pitchers like that. The other thing is like the White Sox just have to be contending is the other one or close to it. I think like with Crochet, that would probably be the case where, you know, if they believed in the pitcher, like let's say like they were, yeah, take wins and losses out of it, take like a contention cycle out of it and just say, you know, do we believe this pitcher will be among the American League's best for 4 years? Let's say they pay him for six, but let's say four. And they can get him for a rate that's like below market, you know, if he hits the market 2 years later. Like it'll look like a steal if he has like one more healthy season like it did with the Red Sox. Would they pay him? Like I don't think Reinsdorf would. Ishbia might. You know, if a case where, like, if the White Sox are 500 or, like, in contention or just made the postseason, it becomes a lot easier to pay a pitcher like that because you don't have to solve that many other positions. I think where the White Sox were, you know, they needed help at, you know, 5, 6, 7 positions. And so having one awesome starter every fifth day does not really provide the boost to get out of it the way it would, like, say, if Kyle Teal is their everyday catcher or most day catcher and Braden Montgomery is their everyday right fielder. And Chase Mydroth is like a decent, if he's your worst infielder, great. If he's your depth infielder, awesome. Like, you know, that's the kind of situation that they would have. And so, like, that gets you to 500-ish a lot faster than, like, one awesome starter and those guys not being around. But if the White Sox are in a position where they're, you know, not rebuilding anymore, or, like, one bad season does not mean, like, that they're going to have to throw it all away and reset the payroll to zero and have to try again, then it probably comes a lot easier to pay a Noah Schultz or Hagen Smith or whoever else is worthy of that kind of contract. So it probably takes two things. And, you know, you hope that by the time Ishbia is taking over, the White Sox are that team that's at least decent to where they don't need to turn one guy into three. But then it's just a matter of, like, do they have the talent on hand to actually do that? And Schultz and Smith, like, you know, yeah, I'm not so nihilistic that I would think, like, one good year is like, okay, start the clock on their free agency. I think that's the nice thing about 2029 and Ishbia being, like, this figure that's occasionally going to be there. You know, perhaps he's somebody, yeah, and this will be a curious dynamic for when the White Sox actually, when it makes sense for them to actually spend, is does, like, he, is he going to be somebody who, like, you know, knocks on Reinsdorf's off and say, like, no, I want this guy to be around when I'm buying the team. And does that make a difference in terms of, like, what kind of resources they have?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if he even has that kind of pull. Based on the comments he said when visiting the Pope, it sounds like he doesn't right now, but could that change in the near future?
Yeah, they're not there this yet to have that conversation. I think, like, if they are a case where, like, you know, it's adding one player, like, say it's the Bryce Harper thing all over again, where a great free agent falls in their lap, or if it's, you know, extending Crochet for a team that can use him to get to the World Series next year, like, those kind of situations. I wonder if you'd see a thing like, hey, this is my investment we're talking about now, not yours.
Right. I bring this up because this is a future problem. Hopefully one we're having a conversation about in 5 to 6 years, because Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, they're awesome. The White Sox are winning, but this is another area. And you wrote about this on SoxMachine.com that the White Sox are having to pivot on the international front. And that's where it's starting to hurt the White Sox as far as their player development and having to reboot that. So far, the early efforts look promising for the White Sox. But again, it is a complete reboot of the international system. It takes time. White Sox have been trading their aces that they have developed, that they become all-stars and dominant in Sale, Crochet, and Cease. They go elsewhere, they find success, and they get paid. Under Jerry Reinsdorf's ownership, these guys would never stay with the White Sox. So that's why, with Justin Ishbia taking over, with Cease signing for this much, it was just an idea that popped in my head. Like, this is another area where maybe things would be different under Justin Ishbia, where instead of White Sox fans having this dread of, like, well, in year 4 and year 5 of control, we have to talk about trading them because there's no way the White Sox are going to sign them to a long-term deal. Maybe that changes with Justin Ishbia, but this would be another area. But yeah, ex-White Sox pitchers, man. Shane Smith continue to pitch well, man.
That's a Brian Bannister dream. Like, having pitchers improve paid. So much yeah. They get paid. Yeah.
Yeah. So far, so good for the ex-White Sox aces. Another old friend finding a new gig. Ethan Katz, former White Sox pitching coach, is now taking the assistant pitching coach job with the Houston Astros. And I saw this one note online, James. I don't think Lucas Giolito is coming back to the White Sox ever. But I wonder if that could be a good pairing. Because Houston's still a contending team. They could use some depth in the starting pitching front. Could you see a reunion of Lucas Giolito and Ethan Katz, but this time in Houston?
I mean, I could. I'm sure they'd be happy to do it. I didn't get the impression that, like, they were, like, professionally married. Like, not like they didn't like working together, but I don't think it's like I'm going to turn down some, like, far better offers or better fits to go play for Ethan type of, like, I think they feel like they can both be effective with others more than like, oh, we have to be a package deal sort of thing. Like, and I think he's got a lot of guys around the league who are like that. Like, in researching and talking to, like, Zach Bove, like, definitely spent the last few weeks, like, talking about things that, like, haven't worked well for White Sox pitching. Like, they've regularly, like, been up there for walk rate. They haven't controlled the run game, and all these, like, sort of details that may fell through the cracks that they're, you know, trying to work at. But that dude's got a lot of starters around the league who worked well with him, took a step forward with him, and think really highly of them. And a lot of them got Cy Young votes last year. So, like, you could say that about him and Rodon. You could say that certainly about him and Cease. Not that he's going to Toronto, but that was, like, a question immediately because his hire got, like, announced right before the season news broke. And so there's like a 12-hour period of, like, oh, does this mean Cease should go to the Astros? So, yeah, maybe that would work for them. I'm sure they'd love it. But I also think, like, there's plenty of guys around the league that he has a good reputation with of working and developing stuff. So this was – some people were – at GM meeting, it's like, man, I as an Ethan landed somewhere. And so this seemed like it was bound to happen. It certainly took a while, probably longer than he wanted, but he's got plenty of success stories to establish he's someone who should have a job in a major league dugout.
Yeah. I feel like Katz will get another opportunity to be a pitching coach for another team. This seems like a short term type of step right now for Ethan Katz, Jim, to take this job with the Houston Astros until another full-time gig as the primary pitching coach job is available with another team.
Yeah, I mean, it can't hurt him in terms of his identity around the league, in terms of not being associated with the White Sox or, like, being so strongly associated with, like, three or 100 lost teams, you know, how many in a row are they going to have? Like, just, you know, if he's doing God's work trying to modernize the pitching apparatus, but, like, it doesn't show up in, like, the top line stats, like, eventually, you know, there are going to be other pitching coaches working their way up, like we've seen with Zach Bove. Like, you don't need necessarily the most traditional backgrounds now. Like, you know, I think it's a case along, you know, around the league with all of other positions, like the traditional climb your way up from one role to another and be a bullpen coach and then, or an assistant pitching coach and then be a pitching coach. Like, you can have faster tracks now, and it's about, like, just what you know and how well you can give it, how well you can work with others. And so, like, you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, Rick Hahn being around the White Sox for 20 years. And, like, does the case where is he not working in baseball right now? Because, like, they think, like, what do you know from working with the White Sox for 20 years that our organization needs? And so I think, like, for Katz to be going to a team that's successful and has a different way of doing it, like, certainly adds to his knowledge. It can't, you know, help but add to his knowledge base as a pitching coach, another way of doing things. And, like, all it takes is, like, a year or two, maybe, with some success stories in Houston, and, like, he's right back in the game getting a full-time pitching coach job, and probably will be okay at it.
Well, we'll see where former White Sox players do sign. And again, we are still waiting for the White Sox to pick up activity as far as the offseason, as we are a week away from the winter meetings. Our next episode, we will be previewing and talking about the things that we are hoping to see happen at the winter meetings. Last year, the first couple of days, a bit slow, not going to lie, a bit slow. And then Garrett Crochet got traded as Jim and I waltzed over to the Rule 5 draft and have to quickly pivot and hustle back to the media room. Ah, that was a fun time. Fun time. But this past weekend, some important birthdays. One, Minnie Minoso, the former great White Sox. Bo Jackson also had a birthday. And Minnie Margulis had a birthday. Happy birthday to Minnie Margulis this past weekend.
Thank you. Yeah, Minnie Minoso's birthday. 5 minutes away from being Pedro Grifols' birthday. The most important 5 minutes of my life. Minnie Margulis was born 12:04 a.m. and I was Grifol was not even a gleam in my eye at that point. But in terms of, like, I did know Minnie Minoso's birthday was the 29th, and, like, as we're going into the OR, I was thinking, like, how long is this going to take in terms of just, like, And then I saw the clock strike 12. I was like, all right, we're good. My wife insists that I dragged my feet going from our room to the OR. Like, I just suit up in PPE, and she just thinks like I slow rolled it just to make sure. Yeah, I did not, for the record, but it worked out all the same.
Well, happy belated birthday to former White Sox manager Pedro Grifol. But with Bo Jackson and doing the Sporacle quiz on SoxMachine.com, which I did all right for Minnie Minoso, named the White Sox hitters have had 30 doubles and 20 homers in a season. I got 53 out of 57. I'm proud of myself. I'll take that. With Bo Jackson turning 63, this thought came into my head, Jim, over the weekend. I don't really fully appreciate everything that Bo Jackson did because I was too young. The 93 White Sox team was my first true love of White Sox baseball, but Bo was coming back from that major hip injury. And I don't really have any memories of Bo Jackson, you know, playing football either at Auburn or with the Raiders. I guess Tecmo Bowl kind of counts, but that's more video game glory than on the field glory for Bo Jackson. So I don't really fully appreciate everything that Bo Jackson did. And there's a part of me that if I can travel back in time, I would love to see Bo Jackson in his prime because he was the guy in the late 80s and early 90s when it came to sports. Bo knows. But it did, Bo's, other than this thought of like going back in time and watching Bo Jackson in his prime, if anyone can go back in time and watch any player in their prime, who would it be? And from a White Sox perspective, Jim, I'll start with you. If you can go back in time at White Sox history and watch any player, any ex-White Sox player in their prime, who would it be?
I have two answers. One is, you know, I'd say go with the earnest one. Like if I had to pick one, no doubt Dick Allen. Just because, you know, the White Sox, because of the park they played in, because of the money they couldn't spend, like, I was trying to think about it. You don't have a whole bunch of like super huge power hitter athlete types that just, you know, you hear about in, you know, of their physical feats. You hear about like pitching, you hear about defense, you hear about base running and such, but you don't hear about like everybody knew the sound of the ball off their bats, or everybody saw just how small they made the field look. And like Allen was like the one guy who like transcended like the White Sox limitations in the environment that they played in. And, you know, just the whole thing of like how, you know, one, how hard he hit the ball, but also like the athleticism, like how good of a base runner he was, reputed to be, like the, and also like, you know, some of the, you know, lesser, or less flattering stuff, like in terms of like the, mercurial attitude and everything like that. I just like to be there real time to kind of understand what that actually was versus hashing out in the newspapers and, you know, he's in the Hall of Fame now because there was a whole lot of revisiting the era and saying like what he actually had to deal with. But like, for better or for worse, I'd be fascinated to go back and see like what that was all about and understand like, you maybe I'd like to go like back to 1969 or something like that to like have White Sox baseball at its most boring and then fast forward to see like what it was like when Allen arrived and just like, oh my God, somebody can actually hit the ball over the fence and somebody can just, be fast enough to like hit inside the park homers, because they just sizzled it past the center fielder, like that kind of, like record scratch of like, wait, this is completely different. And just in the course of like 2 years.
How about you, James? Is there anyone that you would go back in time, ex-White Sox player, that you would want to see in their prime?
I think something since I started covering the game professionally, a lot of it has been feeling like I wish like I could watch players I came up with through like the eyes I have now. I think like especially like doing prospect stuff, the idea of like watching a young like Frank Thomas and realizing like this is, hey, I think this is real, as he's like tearing up like high A pitching would be surreal. The data we have would probably even like make us appreciate him more than like he was in the 90s, even though his traditional stats were obviously very good. Although I could also foresee us like having loud arguments about like whether he should ditch his contact approach and sell out for power. And then the thrill of him doing that later in his career. So I think watching Frank would be, you know, very exciting. I found like watching Eloy in the minors hit like overwhelming. I can only imagine like, you know, a Hall of Famer and not just like, you know, a top five offensive prospect and watch him overmatched. But in talking to like Derek Showman recently, and I think a lot of stuff he mentioned was meeting the talent of the offensive roster where they're at and talking about like, oh, we got to be very situational. We got to be very opportunistic. We have to change up our swing, our approach for, you know, what the opportunity presents itself, knowing that just isn't our team where it can be like, we're going to hit 300 bombs, baby. Let's do it. Like that, I think that's part of why he's saying that, because he's already kind of done research on what the identity of his team is going to be. But in hearing him talk, it sounded so similar to doing a story like for the Athletic, like years back when like Konerko first got on the playoff ballot and talking about having AJ Pruszynski talk about like how he couldn't like even fathom how much like Konerko was like tweaking his swing or tweaking his approach pitch to pitch for like different situations, you know, watching him like go from like stride to no stride during a bat. Like some of this we saw like is just like insane levels of tinkering to a degree that wasn't recommendable for anyone, not even him, for some stretches. But I think he was just kind of such a, and you know, in the bits I've gotten to interview him, he's like so introspective about it, so like self-aware, so like cognizant of how the game has changed. I think covering Konerko would just like be a dream, like the way, like it would be, if I made people sick with like how long like me and Giolito talked and like how long those articles were, like that'd be nothing like talking to Konerko. Like discipline would require like 3,000 word pieces. It'd probably be longer than that. Like he's someone I would just like talk to all day. If like, I imagine if I covered like a 15-year career of Konerko, that would just be insane. Even if like Thomas would be like more awe inspiring in terms of the physical gifts, the way like Konerko could probably articulate how he worked around not having those physical gifts. Oh man. Oh baby.
He speaks in paragraphs.
I'm getting hot just thinking about it. Let's move on.
You could have wrote a book about Pauly.
Still could. Call me. Call
back to Frank Thomas and his minor league numbers. Didn't play a lot of minor league baseball.
Yeah, imagine course, not.
With the White Sox. But with the Birmingham Barons in 1990, Frank Thomas hit .323 with a .487 on base percentage and slugged .581 in 109 games, hitting 27 doubles and 18 home runs.
112 walks in 109 games.
If any White Sox prospect did that today, we'd be going crazy. Like, why is he spending 109 games in Birmingham?
There'd probably be like entire series where he just didn't chase a ball.
Probably. And that was oh man, where was their old stadium for Birmingham?
The Hoover Met?
Yeah, the Hoover. Gamma? That's
or
right.
Older than that.
Yeah. Infested by mosquitoes. Mosquitoes the size of birds. For me, Jim took one part, like Dick Allen back in 1972. But when I was looking up 1972, Jim, Wilbur Wood's season, finishing second in the Cy Young. And that's the thing, like the White Sox have done it a couple times in their franchise history. In 1959 and 1993, where they had both the MVP and the Cy Young winner. And they almost did that in 1972. But while Dick Allen has one of the best war seasons in White Sox history for position player, since integration, I did not know that Wilbur Wood has three of the top five pitching seasons by war, according to Baseball Reference. Like I had no idea, like until I did a minor deep dive into Wilbur Wood, trying to figure out like who would be some guys who would go back in time. So
he
for
pitched all a you zillion OGs, innings.
He did. And then, because he was a reliever, and then he moved over to starter with the White
Sox. He's a knuckleball. He could just keep going.
Yeah, just keep going. Yeah, so for all you OGs, I'm not calling you old, but for all those that grew up with the 1970 White Sox, I'd love to hear those stories. Because, Wilbur Wood, three of the top five White Sox pitching seasons by war in 1972, when you got Wilbur Wood finishing second to Cy Young and Dick Allen winning MVP. If the Sox Machine podcast was a thing back then, You'd be just hyped the entire season. MVP and the guy who almost won Cy Young. That would have been a really fun season.
Yeah, it would have been fascinating. Like, Wood had his kneecap shattered by a line drive in 76. And so, like, his decline phase, like, just he didn't have one. But given, like, what we saw from Tim Wakefield and how long he went, like, it would have been something to see, like, how long Wood could have gone as, like, somebody who routinely threw, like, 250-plus innings. Like,
because he made the Hall of Fame.
He might have gotten started too late to, like, make it, okay. But possibly. And also the White Sox being so bad, like, he would have had to be, like, a, probably somebody who accrues a ton of wins, and, like, he might not have gotten there. Like, he might have been in that Tommy John territory in terms of, like, tons of wins, tons of losses, like, being ordinary for a long time. But, yeah, certainly, like, fascinating profile. And, you know, he's somebody who, like, I'd love to drop him in to current-day baseball. Like, him... give him in his peak form and a catcher can handle him and see, like, would it work? Or like, yeah, how
do
you
even register on StatCast?
Yeah. In terms of, like, just, cause your idea is, like, knuckleballing is not too far off. Maybe throw it harder now than they did, but still, like, it was more that they devoted the resources to actually, like, being able to support it. And so I'd just be fascinating. Like, could it actually work? Even though he wouldn't get Cy Young votes, probably he'd probably get the mistakes would probably get crushed too much. But could he be viable? Somebody like the knuckleball like him. The other idea I had was Zeke Benura, to go back to him because he always comes up in White Sox. But like, he's somebody similar in terms of like power hitter who just arrived, setting home run records at the time. Also, like, his defense was routinely panned in a way like that was very. Colorful, lyrical, ethnically questionable descriptions. they said that his fielding percentage was fine because he didn't get to any ground balls. There's, I think, a Chicago Tribune article that said, like, he would just stand by and wave, and they called it the Mussolini salute. And he disputed it, said Jimmy Dykes, who was the manager at the time, smeared him to the press, and that's why he had such a poor reputation. Fans loved him because he actually, hit the ball over the wall, and not many did. And also had, like, a real fun personality. So I think, like, it would have been fun to go back and see, like, just how bad was that defense? I think Gene Shepard, Christmas Story author and narrator, said that, like, he last got to a ground ball when he's 8 years old. So even, like, he was ripping them, like, just how bad was his defense and how much did it take away from his offense? So that's the other one. I'd rather see Dick Allen, but if I had two, Benura might be second just to understand it.
Got it. Well, podcast listeners, let us know in the comments section on SoxMachine.com who would be an ex-White Sox player if you could travel back in time and watch them in their prime. Can't wait to see what you guys respond with. And then finally on this episode, the Pope. Of course, we got to talk about the Pope because the Pope keeps getting White Sox gifts. On his first trip as Pope, he received a couple of gifts, a Nelly Fox bat and a pair of White Sox slippers. So fun stuff for the Pope. But I have to ask, James, as someone that would actually have questions to ask to the Pope other than the White Sox, at what point will Pope Leo get tired of receiving White Sox gifts?
On the one hand, he might be just like a true sicko and there is no like bottom to like how much White Sox, like maybe this was like, he still can't believe that this is happening, how much stuff he's rolling in from this recent promotion he got at work. And it's, 5 minutes out of his day that he gets photographed, but it's not really, a flood of like, there's not like a room where they in the Vatican where they open the door and like signed baseballs like roll out like a cartoon quite yet. At the same time, yeah, I could see given the severity of like his messaging right now, where it's like most of his availabilities are talking about the situation in Gaza or other like violent conflicts across the globe or the treatment of migrants and all these things he's sharing very urgent concerns about and worrying about how everything is getting worse. That he might be like, would you stop asking me about the 05 White Sox for a second?
Yeah, sure,
I could see something like that happening. But he seems very well-natured, and I I don't know. I think something in seminary training is addresses not blowing up in huge outrages towards people that that he'll probably fall back on that training at some point.
When I saw the slippers, Jim, I laughed. Like, what a, yeah, the Pope's totally going to wear White Sox slippers around the Vatican. And I don't think they'll ever happen, but now there's a part of me that definitely does want to happen. Like, what are the rules? Like, what can the Pope wear? Can the Pope have a White Sox themed robe and walk around in the Vatican? I did not grow up Catholic, so I don't know the answers to these questions, but he's got so much White Sox stuff, I imagine at some point he wants to wear it.
Yeah, I mean, I wondered when he was elected Pope, I was trying to think of like White Sox fans in church, and you think about like going to mass in January, and it was always, I look back at it finally now because you still see him in circulation, but like the nice White Sox jacket or the nice like Bears coat, like the layer, like the leather sleeves. And it was like, this is clear, like this is my formal White Sox jacket.
My father-in-law's got one of those, yes.
Yes, and like he's got to have one of those. And like I'd love to see him going to church and like this is what I considered this is what was considered like Sunday nice for South Side of Chicago in winter masses. And so like, what was that jacket? He had to have one. So there's that. The thing about like I was thinking about the perspective, like I don't think I would give the Pope a Nelly Fox bat if I had one. Like he doesn't need it. He wouldn't ask for it. Like the whole idea is, it's the reason for the season, that sort of thing. But I guess like it doesn't really matter. I would say probably anything that like makes Catholics in America more invested in Catholicism. Like he probably sees it like, all right, that's if people are talking about me for baseball and Chicago stuff and making hot dog jokes, like that's, any publicity in that sense is good publicity because it means like that they're at least thinking about the church. And, that might be something that needs some emphasis back home. But yeah, it is. He doesn't have the concerns of like, where do I put this? Or am I going to see these people again? Like, are they going to, because like, hey, how come you're not wearing your White Sox slippers? Or how come I saw an Ellie Fox bat on the Vatican Facebook marketplace because he didn't want it around? Like, I saw that listing too. We live in the same geographical location. I can click on your profile. I know who this is. Like, you don't have to worry about regifting or anything like that. So pretty safe to get stuff and harmless to get stuff and just, smile and shake a hand or, wave and be okay with it.
Two things. I don't think any publicity is good publicity is the position of the Catholic Church in 2025.
I mean, like in the case of like baseball stuff, Chicago stuff, like all Chicago related American publicity is fine. White Sox publicity. This is the one case where White Sox publicity helps more than hurts.
I don't know if it will happen. I think it's probably more likely not than will, but I have at least mentally prepared myself that at some point to see the Pope in a 108ing shirt, like within the next 5 years. I think that's at least on the board. God. We've seen like so many other institutions that we thought would not be sullied in a certain way. I think that's on the board as well.
Those boys did grow up Catholic, so that could be a possibility. I mean, if the Pope wants some bobblehead, I mean, if he will take any White Sox gear, Pope Leo, I get a box of it every year as a season ticket holder that gets dropped off at my house in January. I'll ship it to you. I'll ship it to you in the Vatican to curry favor. Maybe we can have Pope Leo be a guest on an upcoming episode of the Sox Machine podcast. If that's all that takes, Pope Leo, I can send you stuff every year to the Vatican. Just after the White Sox slippers, though, I don't know what to expect as far as ridiculous White Sox gifts. But it's been a lot. It's been a lot for the Pope. Maybe he'll want some Chicago Bears stuff because they're good now.
I was at a mass where Ozzie Guillen was quoted in a homily, like that was like 15 years ago. I think the barrier is already pretty thin.
All right. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Again, our next episode will be in a few days as we wait to see if there's any activity around Major League Baseball, but that will be our winter meetings preview. Again, a huge thank you to all of our Sox Machine subscribers. And Jim, I know on Small Business Saturday, we had a deal going on SoxMachine.com for those that wanted to sign up for a subscription. We did get some good publicity on Reddit. So thank you to all those that visit in White Sox Reddit and chime in and talk about us over there. So thank you. But as far as that deal, does that extend through Cyber Monday?
Sure does, because we are a small business site and also a cyber site, a cyber small business. So consider it Cyber Small Business Monday. Extra month free on all annual plans.
Excellent. There you go. So you only pay for 10 and you get 12 months. Great timing. Because again, with the winter meetings, anything that we hear or report on, you can get all of our access down in Orlando. We do have some spots open in our Veterans Committee. Thank you to Zach Ferguson for being our latest VC. There's going to be a lot of information fed into the VC group chat as we feed them all the gossip and whispers that we are hearing from the media room and on the floor.
Gospers. Say it, Josh. Say gospers.
Gospers.
Say the thing.
Gospers. Combination of two. But if you are interested in helping us out and you want all of our access, if you want access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, take advantage of that annual subscription deal at SoxMachine.com. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. If you are on Blue Sky, we are at SoxMachine.com. James is at JR Fegan. You're definitely going to want to follow him, especially with the winter meetings next week, coming out of those media scrums with Chris Getz on each of those days. And, of course, the MLB draft lottery and the Rule 5 draft. He's at JR Fegan. You can follow him on Blue Sky at JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. I am at Sox Machine Josh. You could also follow me on Blue Sky at Josh.SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.